You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 217A by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Catherine Krieger. It's a set of essays and addresses to the youth, entitled Youth and the Etheric Heart. Rudolf Steiner speaks to the younger generation. This is Part 8, entitled Three Main Questions for the Anthroposophical Youth Movement, Address and Question and Answer Session, given in Stuttgart on February 14, 1923. I believe I can safely assume that you are all familiar with the appeal that has been issued to the members of the Anthroposophical Society in Germany. In anthroposophical circles, we have realized that it is time to set a new course, and we are aware that this shift also requires a change in the Society's leadership, as it has been exercised in Stuttgart up to the present. The details of the change will be discussed at the upcoming Delegates' Assembly. I believe that you will be especially interested in everything that happens there. When the outer circumstances of your life led you to seek anthroposophy, you found the society in a certain condition. You imagined that there must be some place where young people could find what they seek from the depths of their souls, but cannot discover in modern worldly institutions. You were embedded in these institutions and discovered that their recent historical development did not correspond to the demands of the human soul. Perhaps you looked for a place where this demand for true humanity could be met, and eventually you believed you had found it in the Anthroposophical Society, but the reality did not live up to your expectations. Not all of you felt conflicted as the result of this situation. You were dissatisfied with some things, but let it go at acknowledging your dissatisfaction. Both old and fresh realities within the Anthroposophical Society are forcing us to face the fact that the Society simply has not kept pace with the development of anthroposophy. We must seriously consider whether to create something completely new or to allow the old Anthroposophical Society to continue, but with a new impulse. These questions are being considered by individuals who were involved more or less closely in leading the society. They are looking at many old sins, mainly sins of omission, and debating whether to abandon some bureaucratic structures. With the understanding of the representatives of the Anthroposophical Society in Germany, they are attempting to create a basis for the society's continuance. Developments in recent years have brought together a large number of very good workers in Stuttgart. As individuals, they are all excellent people, and collectively, they are a truly great movement in their own way. But they also get in each other's way, as one of the leading individuals put it. This has proved unproductive in many respects. Individuals have done their jobs very well. We have good reason to be satisfied with the performance of the Waldorf School. But despite the presence and activity of anthroposophists, the Anthroposophical Society has been gradually disappearing and falling out of favor. We must put an end to this process or the society will fall apart completely. Clearly, you were very aware that this was going on and formed your own opinions about it. The society needed a new form, and it had to come from the old backers. After all, the bulk of the Anthroposophical Society's membership has contributed 23 years of work. Many of them are in a very different situation, but still find something that persists. If the branch falls apart, the individual anthroposophists remain, and anthroposophy continues to spread. An example of this is Mrs. Wolfram, who led the Leipzig branch for years before stepping down. Recently she founded a local group of the Bund für freies Geistesleben, Federation for Independent Spiritual Life, in deliberate contrast to the local anthroposophical circle. As the example of Leipzig illustrates, the current branch leader is a former student, replacing old forces with young ones is not enough. We must create a balance between the results of 2 decades of work and the fresh forces of new arrivals. Our appeal to members is intended to represent this balance in the right way. Many members join the Anthroposophical Society seeking a calming element, so it was always very unpleasant for them when the need arose to use pointed language against outside opponents. We will not be able to avoid this in the future either, because the opposition is assuming ever stronger forms that require an atypically defensive position from us. We must not lose sight of this fact. For older people who become accustomed to the calming element, being good anthroposophists today is difficult. It is very bad when our experiences of anthroposophy become habitual. Anthroposophy actually needs to be acquired anew every day. It is not enough to simply remember what we have already covered. The difficulties of the old Anthroposophical Society are due to the unfortunate fact that human beings are creatures of habit. Anthroposophy, however, must not become a habit. Difficulties also arise because anthroposophy challenges us to rise above all egotism, even with regard to our knowledge. Like other living things, human beings can be self-centered, of course, but anthroposophy and egotism are a bad match. It is possible to be egotistical and still be a tolerably good materialist, or even a tolerably good person in general, but you get into constantly recurring contradictions if you are egotistical and an anthroposophist. This dilemma is due to the fact that human beings actually do not live entirely on the earth. When we descend to the earth from our pre-birth existence, a bit of each of us remains behind in the astral realm. Similarly, when we wake up in the morning, not all of our supersensible being enters the body. We leave part of our existence behind in the supersensible world. But since social structures are based entirely on earthly circumstances, it is impossible to establish a totally satisfactory social order in which human beings can be completely happy. I have said repeatedly that organizing social life in a threefold way is not heaven on the earth. It simply demonstrates the possibilities of the body social. To claim more would be deceiving, because human beings are not exclusively earthly beings. We must be aware of this fact if we are to sense our full humanity. But if we do, we can never be satisfied with a merely materialistic worldview. We are ready for anthroposophy only when we truly sense our full humanity. That is, when we realize that we cannot descend to earth completely, when we acknowledge the needs of our supersensible aspect. Obviously, you yourselves felt something of this sort quite instinctively and found your way to the Anthroposophical Society as a result. But now this situation has led to certain difficulties. On the one hand, anthroposophy must never become a habit. On the other, anthroposophy cannot be taken up by beings who are exclusively earth-oriented. Anything that merges into egotism becomes earth-related. Consequently, people become worse human beings when they are both supersensibly oriented and egotistical. The supersensible being assumes the character of a material being. Spiritual feeling and sensing are incompatible with egotism. At this point, obstacles begin to appear. But this is also the point where the anthroposophical movement coincides with your search, which is based on the circumstance that all connection to the spiritual world has been lost. In your search for your humanity, you are attempting to escape from our superficial institutions. You must attempt to come to grips with what already exists while being aware of your inner being. If you can relate the difficulties you encounter to the difficulties of others, together we will find our way to a strong anthroposophical society, including those circles seeking inner experience, and a strong anthroposophical movement in the near future. If you choose this path, you will experience privation and difficulties, because humankind does not want such a movement to exist. more experiences are in store for you before you will be truly ready to join our cause with your whole being. Then Anthroposophy will assert itself under all circumstances. The breakdown of the civilized world is so pronounced that Europe cannot survive for long if it does not turn to the Spirit. Only Spirit will allow our civilization to rise again. Hence, it is absolutely necessary for human beings to seek the Spirit, and you have made the right choice. The next step is to decide on our work for the near future. We are meeting today to hear about how you imagine this work and what your intentions are. Question. A participant asks, what form scholarly work should take today? Rudolf Steiner. With regard to scholarly work, none of what will need to be present in the future exists yet, which is not to say that there is absolutely nothing now. Already present in all branches of academic knowledge are the outer facts that we must move forward into areas that will be needed in the future if human souls are not to become corrupted. A number of fields of scholarly research have already produced significant results, from the smallest collections to the London Museum. With regard to the academic knowledge of the future, however, current researchers are inwardly dead and therefore cannot do anything with these resources. Because they arrived at this body of material through an automatic, unconscious development of sorts, they do not know what to do with the information they have. The dilemma for anthroposophists is not that it is impossible to approach these fields from the anthroposophical perspective. The comprehensive ideas and spiritual perceptions are already available. But that the body of facts needed for academic research is monopolized by people who do not know what to do with it. The people who ought to be describing the contents of our culture stand there empty-handed. Meanwhile, the body of facts is not being presented to university students in ways that encourage seeing these facts in the right light. For example, when you are shown a skeleton in zoology class or a plant in botany, you do not get anything out of it. You simply learn that the skull goes here, the shoulder blade there, the tibia down here, and so on. A table or a machine could be described in the same way. When your instructors show you a skeleton, you cannot develop any feeling for the process of its growth and development. It is shown to you as if it were nothing more than a machine that can be broken down into its component parts. But what do you see if you first learn to imbue your perceptions with soul? For example, if you look along the spine of a dog skeleton from back to front, you can see that moon forces are at work in the tail end and sun forces in the skull, while earth forces work along the legs. This becomes a matter of direct perception if we do not prevent people from seeing it by failing to teach them how to perceive in this way. As I just said, we would have to be able to see it in the same way that we see and remember a sculpture of a human figure. The fact that it represents a human being is a matter of direct perception. In the same way, we ought to be able to see that sun and moon forces are active in the skeleton of a dog. We simply need an adequate basis for such perceptions. At the moment, however, those who have access to the facts do not know what to do with them, and those who actually need these scholarly resources do not have access to them. This is why we say there is nothing there, but we might equally well say that everything is already there. The great difficulty is in finding one's way. If students today have not been gifted with exceptionally favorable karma, or if their souls have not been guided in ways that allow them to acknowledge the existence of a spiritual world, they are led away from that world. And the fact that a spiritual world exists seems simply ludicrous to them. Students today realize, for example, that an embryo develops within the mother's body, but it does not occur to them that a human or animal embryo would have to be seen as the product of elements of reality. specifically that embryonic development depends on protein breakdown in a certain part of the maternal body. This breakdown, however, is interrupted by the intervention of cosmic forces, and the entire macrocosm is then reflected in miniature in proteins that are reconstituted as soon as they are broken down. As a result, the form of the cosmos asserts itself in the development of the embryo. The maternal organism simply supplies matter, which must first be broken down so the cosmos can build it up again. Considering embryonic development from the perspective of modern science is like taking a paper rose and claiming that it is freshly picked from the bush. Such examples make it obvious that a complete reversal is needed not only in all areas of academic knowledge, but also in art and religion. Even in religion, the worst sort of materialism prevails. In Germany, the situation is especially difficult right now. People are gradually losing the courage to go on living. This courage, however, can come only from the supersensible world. Of course, doubt is possible, but doubt comes from the sense-perceptible world, whereas the courage to overcome doubt and to perceive in the right way comes from the supersensible world. During the course of scientific lectures that I gave in Dornach at Christmas, I pointed out that wherever atoms appear, death is present. Atomism is the science of dead matter. Many of the facts confirmed by modern science are pulling it closer to anthroposophical scientific view. Facts pointing to spiritual science can be found everywhere. Radium, for example, is the most striking example of decaying matter spitting out atoms. Facts pointing to the spirit are everywhere, but superficial science lacks the courage to follow these pointers. Also, a much faster-moving global economy replaced our many different national economies in the 19th century. The slower tempo of national economies is evident even in the smallest areas. The trains that the old national economy used to run were much slower than those arriving in Stuttgart today, which are run by the global economy. Attempting to revert from a global economy to national economies will simply destroy what has already been accomplished. Question. A participant asks how to develop a relationship to architecture and sculpture. Rudolf Steiner. One's worldview is very important in this regard. The modern worldview, that takes mere logic and sensory observation as its starting points, is forced to imagine that the world ceases to be accessible at a certain point. We have set outer natural limits that we can no longer get past. Our logic consists of inner laws that we impose on ourselves. It does not include nature at all. All knowledge, even purely scholarly knowledge, must merge into pure artistry. We must teach ourselves to be artists so that we can shape forms as nature shapes them. We can learn this as soon as we discover where nature becomes an artist. We must deepen our knowledge of nature to such an extent that we see plants, animals, and humans as artists. Only then will we recognize the infinitely interesting static and dynamic proportions encompassed by the human body, for example. We will see how each bone represents a system of beams or girders. We will understand the difference between standing with legs apart in the frontal plane and stepping forward. Each human body is a very subtle architectural structure. Older religious creeds taught their candidates for initiation about the miraculous ways in which human bodies are embedded in the cosmos through their dynamic and static proportions. When we look at a statue of the Buddha, we see the dynamics and stasis of the human body. The broad base of the legs, crossed below the torso, emphasizes the structure and static character of the torso. Architectural forms are derived from how human beings move and stand. A perfectly proportioned building is nothing other than a perfect, idealized human being, standing and walking. Each culture's architecture understands and represents the dynamics and stasis of human bodies in its own particular way. Assyrian and Babylonian culture represents the proclamation of the Logos, through the human body, bending forward. Greek culture, through the standing body, at rest. To achieve a living knowledge of all architectural forms, we must simply know how the human body takes its place within the cosmos. Today, architectural imagination is severely limited. Nonetheless, modern architecture must be born out of our own experience as human beings, out of the "know thyself," in quotes. This is what we attempted in the Gertianum. When we move from the proportions of human movement to proportions of human form, we shift from architecture to sculpture. Sculpture is the experience of the proportions of human form. The transition from architecture to sculpture means that movement shifts from balance to form. The more our knowledge of the human being advances, the more possible it will be to develop art and differentiated architecture and sculpture that will reflect the nature of the human being. To make this transition to the human form, however, we now need an independent social realm based on selflessness and love. The Greeks were still able to experience their own individual forms through individual embedding in the cosmos. In contrast, modern human beings must discover sculpture by synthesizing their perceptions of other people. The Greeks did not need to observe other people. They discovered sculpture by experiencing their own bodies. Art is based on revealing hidden forces of nature. We need art in order to understand the human being and to understand nature. Modern sculpture needs to incorporate a living artistic view of the human. In the human being, we must learn to see luciferic activity in the form of the head, as I attempted to show it in the group sculpture in the Gertianum, and the counterpole of hardening, the activity of Ahriman, in the bony skeleton. Their interaction then shapes the ideal human body. We must again achieve the human form. Hebrew culture followed through with the moral impulses inherent in its religion in a profound way, but it did not dare to make an image of its God. As human cultural development continued, we gradually achieved a logically empirical conception of human nature and lost the artistic aspect of our understanding. The result was the separation of worldview and art. On the one hand, we have our logically empirical worldview, and on the other, artistic imagination. As yet, no connection has been established between consideration of laws uncoupled from the human being and artistic arbitrariness. The architecture and sculpture of the future will need to be created out of an understanding of the entirety of the human form. Comment from a participant. What can you say about the difficulties students have in getting anthroposophically oriented papers accepted? Rudolf Steiner. The Anthroposophical Society must realize how important it is not to allow anthroposophical accomplishments to go unrecognized. It must learn to appreciate works such as Dr. von Baraval's or Carolyn von Heidebrand's pamphlet on the negative aspects of experimental psychology and educational experiments. Assuming that our research institutes succeed in answering the questions I have posed in my lecture cycles on natural history, we must gradually reach a point where even our opponents develop respect for the work done under the auspices of the Anthroposophical Society. We must train ourselves and others to acknowledge individual accomplishments in anthroposophical settings. When this becomes a matter of conscience in the society, professors will no longer be able to reject anthroposophically oriented papers without cause. People with practical experience in our research institutes must support the efforts of students working on dissertations or papers for seminars. The Anthroposophical Society must develop enough clout so that professors will refrain from rejecting anthroposophically oriented papers of adequate substance for fear of having the society breathing down their necks. Bracket, Rudolf Steiner asks whether student representatives will attend the delegates' assembly. close bracket. Comment from a participant. A student representative talks about the delegates' assembly. Rudolf Steiner. It would be good if you could be as thorough and serious as possible, answering the three primary questions involved here. First, how are things going with the student and youth movements in general? Second, what are those who sense their full humanity on the basis of anthroposophy experiencing in universities? Third, what do students and other young people expect of the Anthroposophical Society? We need a vivid understanding of these issues in order to act on them effectively. In the early 1870s, Nietzsche gave a vivid and brilliant account of the state of our educational institutions. He described what schools ought to be like and what he expected of them. Unfortunately, Nietzsche's contribution to this subject has been almost forgotten. Today, we would have to ask for even more than Nietzsche did. The three questions I just listed are the most important. All will go well if we have people at the core of the Anthroposophical Society who are not only highly interested in their areas of specialization, but also attentive to everything going on in the society and in the world at large. Such interest and attentiveness have been lacking, as evidenced by the fact that the development of the movement for religious renewal went almost unnoticed until its first public appearance. Universal attentiveness and interest must enter the Anthroposophical Society. Thoughts do not grow, they remain unchanged. Attentiveness and interest, however, can grow and bear fruit. Above all, we must clearly and decisively seek out and follow the path to supersensible worlds. If we do so, we will also find the right relationship to our fellow human beings. And the opposite is also true. Having found the right way to relate to human beings, we will be on the verge of entering the supersensible worlds. That's the end of part 8.